Oh yes, you're tuned into Tributaries. I just wanted to set the stage for listening to Tom Muskell, author of How to Speak Whale. I'm Robin with Tributaries. Tom, tell us about whale song from a humanly felt experience.
Oh, what a great question. What's really interesting about whale song is that it depends how you take it in. The first time I heard it was just in clips on television, and that was nothing compared to sitting in a quiet room and playing a whale song at its whole length. Roger Payne, who discovered whale song, and also John Ryan, who studies it, has advised me that you shouldn't listen to bits of it, that they're whole performances, and you should take in the whole performance, as you would with any piece of music. So I tried that, and that was wonderful. And then I tried it with a huge speaker, a subwoofer, that could rumble your body in the deep sounds that human ears are unable to hear. And that was an even more beautiful and emotional experience. It was very hard to describe. I felt almost teary, and I wondered if it was because it was like being in the womb or something, when you feel the music going through you. And then when I eventually got to have the opportunity of getting in the water near singing whales, that was something entirely different, because then you can see the performer, you can see the whale, and your whole body resonates. It's like you're almost part of what it's playing with its voice. And it's almost impossible to describe, because it's unlike anything else. The closest thing, I think, is I've been to some really big parties, and when you're near some of the biggest speakers and everything rumbles, like the hairs in your nostrils kind of fizz, and your chest and lungs and sinuses all resonate. It's like that, but with something, I mean, these guys have been singing for perhaps millions of years.
Yeah, when you said that when you were in the water, you were really part of the song, there's such a strong resonance that goes on between all of us beings, and it's so beautiful how that is really being felt in a palpable way these days.
Absolutely. And I think Roger Payne makes the excellent point that we don't really understand why we like music. We know that we like it. We know it makes us feel good. But unlike food, you know, we know we like food because we have to eat. But why are we so drawn to music? Why do you spend so much of our time making it, listening to it? And we often see other animals have responses to music that are very positive and inquisitive. And he feels that perhaps music is a very ancient thing in our bodies and our evolutionary history.
Yes, and that brings up so much about birdsong and the whale song, which we are getting into now. As some may know, you literally had a whale breach out of the water and come down on your kayak. Tell us how long ago that was, and what stays with you the most today about that experience?
It was 7 years ago now. We were in Monterey Bay, and an adult humpback did a full breach out of the water very unexpectedly and landed on us and hit the kayak and dragged us underwater. And I've often been asked, it was a two-person kayak, whether I was sort of traumatized. And I don't know if I'm lucky, but I wasn't really. All my main memory of it is of just how visceral it is. And even when you're in the water and you're looking at other animals, there is a slight feeling of detachment, or at least I have that, perhaps because I'm used to life on land. But when you see an animal of that size in the air and you're able to see it so clearly with your eyes, I can just remember all the wrinkles and the texture of its skin, the kind of massiveness of it, which when it's floating, you don't get so much. I mean, I guess imagine if a boat was suddenly falling on you, you'd suddenly realize how metal or wooden it was. It made me really aware that it was a big, heavy, living being.
Yes, indeed.
Just exhilarating. It was just like an enormous rush, you know, and I think part of that was because I was so fortunate not to die. So I think it's all caught up in this feeling of being lucky. I thought I was going to die, and then afterwards I didn't. And so if one of us had been badly hurt, it would be such a different memory, but it isn't because we were so fortunate.
What was your first thought when you were approached by the Silicon Valley kids and they brought a certain reality to literally asking a whale a question and expecting an answer?
My background is I'm a biologist who turned into a filmmaker, and I had been spending some time with scientists who were doing all sorts of impressive things enabled by new technologies, like putting recording devices deep underwater where we could hear whales, or onto their bodies in ways that didn't upset them, so we could see the world from their point of view. And I'd noticed that basically people were getting very overwhelmed. So I went to biological acoustics conferences, and all the scientists there brought their recordings of the living world. But there was so much of it that they were kind of a bit stuck. How did they find their way through it all? And it was when I met these two men who founded a thing called the Earth Species Project. And their background was in the Silicon Valley tech world. And they wanted to contribute to the natural world that they were very worried about. And they'd seen this opportunity for taking artificial intelligence, a form of machine learning, which is essentially just pattern recognition in language. So machines that had been developed to find patterns in human language. And they thought that they could train those machines on these big data sets of animal vocalizations that we were getting, specifically whales, and find patterns in them and make progress where we've really got quite stuck in trying to decode the communications of other animals. My main thought was, like, whether this works or not, I want to know what it will find, because it seemed such a powerful tool to step outside our human senses and see things we were unable to. So my main thought was, that makes lots of sense. It sort of puts together lots of the things I've seen so far, with mainly just jumping ahead to, okay, cool, let's test it. Will it work?
So what I think about when thinking of these biologists becoming expert pattern recognizers, is it just an endless rabbit hole? And because we will see repeated patterns, does that start creating some kind of law of nature in our mind, when actually maybe the scope really truly is so much bigger than what we're able to see or focus on? Are we creating laws of nature that don't really exist except in our minds? Does that ever cross your mind?
It's a good question. Whenever we take information from the world and we process it, and we tell each other stories around it to explain our experiences and what we're seeing, in a way, we're always creating things that we know are not entirely true. Look at human history, every way that we've found to explain what's occurring in front of us. Looking back, we can see where we've misunderstood, maybe not seen the whole picture. And I feel this is likely an extension of that. I don't feel that the things that humans do are unnatural. I feel that the idea that humans are separate from nature is wrong. I feel we are extensions of a part of nature, and our technologies and our expressions of our interactions with the world are also nature. And they can be damaging, but they can also be enlightening. And absolutely, we can mislead ourselves by incorrectly interpreting what's in front of us. If we don't understand how we set these machines up, they could make us think there's things there that aren't, if we don't know how to interpret the information. But I think that's more about how we go about it, and being critical and transparent and sharing, rather than anything that's inherent in the use of these particular technologies.
Agreed, certainly. And your book, How to Speak Whale, brings together so many aspects of communication with animals. Tell us about some of the more profound research, either research and or technology in this search.
Well, an example in whales and dolphins is the use of deep learning machine algorithms. If you give a data set of lots of recordings of, say, common dolphins to a scientist, if their dolphins are all talking on top of one another, it's very hard for them to try and make use of that information. One of the tools that's come about in the last couple of months has been to address this. This is called the cocktail party problem, in that if you turn up in a room and there's loads of people talking at once, figuring out who's talking and what's being said is hard. So one of the tools separates out all the voices of all the different dolphins. It can also do it for bats and people and dogs. And that enables you to separate out these voices. You can then start to analyze what the patterns are within them. And you can combine that with information about what those animals were doing at that time. It's very hard to figure out meaning in communication and language without context. There's a big project going on right now called Project SETI of Dominica, where they're trying to get the biggest animal behavior data set of all time, where they're rigging the whole ocean, a section of it, with listening devices, around a resident sperm whale population has been studied for over 20 years. So they know all the different whales. The whales that organize their lives into different acoustic clans, those sperm whales have loads of different vocalizations called coders, which they use to teach one another how to live and survive, and their different hunting techniques, how to protect each other, how to look after one another's young when the mothers are feeding deep below, that kind of thing. But we don't really know what those coders mean, if anything. We just know that they're used for whales that have those lives. So now what they're doing is they're taking these new tools of these recording devices that can go where we can't go, and they're going to put them there for a very long time, including soft robotic fish that will swim among the whales without disturbing them, and recording devices on the whales so that they can see who is talking and what they're doing. And then they're going to feed months and months and years of the information that comes from that into these pattern recognizing engines that will sort out who's talking, what happened next, how complex are the communications, how often do they make them, how many different kinds are there, kind of like trying to figure out their vocabulary range. Does that change as they age? How do baby whales learn to talk? And what are the first things they say? And how does that change over their lives? Dolphins seem to have things called signature whistles, which are analogous to names for themselves. How do they learn them? When do they learn them? Do they change over their lives? And which other individuals use them? And they'll start to build up these huge data sets, find more and more patterns within them. And then linguists will start trying to test their theories for what the basis of that whale communication system is. And they'll use chatbots, as in like human chatbots, not on the whales, to sort of test their theories sort of outside of the whales virtually. And then they'll make predictions based on that. And then they'll be able to see, what did the whales say next? Our predictions thought they might say this. Oh, it's wrong. Then our model is not right. Oh, we were right. Perhaps we're closer to understanding the way that they structure their interactions and communication. And it's basically the beginning. We don't live very long, so I can't just listen to a sperm whale's entire life of communications and then listen to all the other sperm whales and compare them in my head. But our computers can help us with that.
Right.
So, I mean, I guess that's a really huge example, but that's the most exciting one.
Yeah, I read this book by a free diver, and he said that there was such a difference between being in the water as a free diver, and you were more like a fish or a whale or a dolphin in the water. And he was commenting how the interaction then changed with those animals under the water.
Yes, absolutely. They change totally. A lot of whales don't like it if you've got scuba equipment because the bubbles come out. And they seem to find that distressing and they'd avoid you. I've scuba dived a lot, and then I learned to free dive, and I found it was very different and freeing. The kind of range of movements I could make and the amount of attention I had all around me was very different.
Yes.
And a level further beyond that is if you're not there at all and you're not changing their behavior. But like if you can send machines to go there that do not disturb them or upset them or distract them, but they can relay to you what their lives are like without you getting in the way. But I also do feel that it's a shame to decide to remove ourselves from those systems, because humans and cetaceans have interacted historically in many places over history, and those interactions do not have to be negative.
Yeah. It's interesting, too. You write in your book about various animals and birds, and anatomy surely plays into not only the sounds, but the language as well. And I was interested in this one fact that you brought up about how the neurons in a whale's brain are spaced far apart in comparison to other animals, which, of course, would make the processes slower in the brain. Do you think the fact that they are underwater and sound travels so fast or faster underwater that that's perhaps why? Or is there any correlation beyond that that's been found?
The whales have very, very large brains. The sperm whale's brain is the biggest brain of any animal. The way we've chosen to interpret their brains has changed as our understanding of how brains work has changed. And we still don't understand very well how our own brains work and the impact of different neuron sizes and shapes and configurations. They have a lot of neurons, and some of them transmit very, very quickly. They don't pack as many in some ways as we do, but they also don't need to because they've got much more space. So it might just be that the evolutionary pressure to cram lots of neurons in close together isn't as great. Maybe it's an advantage to them. Maybe they get sometimes slower transmission speeds between them, but they're also able to get rid of metabolic byproducts more easily because there's more drainage. I don't know. What we do know is that they seem to have really, really complex brains with large surface areas, lots of grey matter. There's lots of wrinkles in them, and they have kinds of neurons that we have thought were only in humans before, and they're big. Some of them aren't big relative to their body size, but when you get down to the porpoises and the dolphins, they are still pretty big compared to their body size. So all of those things indicate that they have a lot of cognition going on. What that means in terms of what they can think and how they do think is still almost a total mystery. I went to see a sperm whale brain being scanned and a minke whale brain being scanned. And the people who do those scans, they've scanned almost more brains than anybody else in the world. But they're still pretty in the dark about what the scans mean, apart from that they're not stupid. That's the main thing. But how that compares to how we think is unclear. I guess the only thing you can really almost say for certain is they will be able to do things with their brains that we cannot, which means we probably can't imagine them very well. They feel more.
Right. Considering that language goes beyond the spoken word and really using other senses to communicate, I'm wondering, have you been inspired to develop your other senses since you've begun all of this deep dive, no pun intended, into this world? And and I imagine that being in the water with dolphins and whales might bring that on.
I think I've become very aware of the limits of my own senses and the limits of my own vocabulary. I've written this book and I've spent 4 years researching it, and that has been an exercise in trying to describe in human words. And it's really brought home to me how linked to our own language, to our own visual systems. You know, if I say to you, I really don't see what you mean.
Yes.
Whereas whales don't see very much. Their eyes are not their primary way of understanding and perceiving the world. They might not have a communication system that's based on concepts, visual concepts. How would a whale explain what being wet is a good example of that. Hockett's principles of language come from a paradigm that humans are the only animals that have natural language. And this researcher tried to break down all the different parts of what makes a human natural language. There are many criticisms of this. One of them is that every time we find animals that can do some of these things, we change and add more principles in so that we can still say that we're the only ones with all the principles of a language. So
what a surprise.
Right. Really interesting, because you get this with intelligence, and like the definition of intelligence is fluid. And I feel that when you have a field where the basic definitions of what you're trying to investigate change, that means you're at quite an early stage of even understanding what those things are, let alone how widespread they are and how they compare across the species boundaries. It's very hard to compare intelligence between human beings. So how do we even do that between species? There was a long debate about whether sign language was a real language. Whereas clearly, if people can use it to represent their beliefs, desires, things happening in the future, their inner state, it has what many people would think of in a lay perspective as a language. So I think the word languages can sometimes be a distraction.
Yes.
What I find is more interesting is, how do we represent our world to each other and our thoughts and our feelings and perceptions and ideas? And could our other animals have ways of doing that? I mean, surely, I think they can. I'm almost more interested in exactly what you'd asked about the limits of human perception. And that's why I'm quite optimistic about the use of machines, which, as a conservation biologist, I'm very skeptical of, because they have facilitated such destruction. But I also see them here being useful in making us shake off our human-centered way of looking at things.
You know, who knows which comes first, the chicken or the egg? And talk to a shaman about ayahuasca plants, and they'll tell you flat out that the plants are leading the way. We're not the ones discovering the plants you put together to make ayahuasca and then going into the tripping or dream world.
Mm.
So our curiosity about the whole world and asking all these questions, for me, being an outsider, I wonder if the question of why we want to speak to whales comes into question.
It's a very valid question. And I think, obviously, I have been speaking and using the word we in this conversation so far, mainly to represent my background. I live in London, I'm Northern European, educated in the scientific perspective. But that's just one human perspective, and it is limited. And there are many cultures that have been and continue to be, that have other valid and insightful ways of seeing and understanding other species and the living world and communications between them. And I find that myself just fascinating, and I would love to learn more. I cover a story in the book of the Aboriginal Australian people. There are people in Australia who've been there for tens of thousands of years who have traditions in a place called Eden, where the Aboriginal people of that area, the Yuin people, would call dolphins down to the water, and the dolphins, and they would talk to each other, and the dolphins would help them fish, and they would help the dolphins to fish. And there were people who would hunt whales there, where there were traditions of the Aboriginal people of that area teaming up with orcas to hunt other whales, and then they would share the whales that were killed, the tongues, with the killer whales that lived there. And there are many of these interactions between humans and cetaceans, and many with humans and other species, in the stories and activities of people all over the world. And they are described as communications and speaking by many of those people. It's easy to understand why you'd speak to whales there if you were teaming up to survive or
yes,
for joy. I think now why many of the scientists who are doing the research that's covered in the book are doing it is because they're very concerned about our broken relationship with nature. And they've seen the example of the discovery of whale song in the 1960s and the impact that had on how we changed our course from slaughtering whales to protecting them.
Mm.
And they feel that when we see things that other animals do, when we recognize ourselves in them or elements of ourselves in them, that drives us to change destructive ways towards them. And that if we are to see something we think of as so human as communication and language in another, then we would find it very difficult to hurt them as we are, and that we would change. So that's the why. And that doesn't require us to speak to them. That really requires us just to listen to them.
Yes. Well, isn't that the key for all of us in life, is to zip the mouth for a while and give a good listen inside and out, right? I just feel like speaking to anyone or anything involves more intelligence and love at the base of language. And I love how you just brought up that the conservation is a natural outcome. And that's where I was going with the plants and the ayahuasca. You know, it's like, who's leading who? Mm-hmm. And of course, it doesn't matter. Yeah. We just have to recognize our part and our place in that. Yeah.
Yes. I think it's about being curious and respectful. And that if we are given up in new opportunities, to follow them, but carefully. Yeah, perhaps I should have called the book How to Listen Whale, but that doesn't sound so good. But that's really much more what it's about, is learning how to listen better with help.
Yeah. Well, speaking of this book, Tom, you are a documentary filmmaker and an author, and I'm wondering if you have anything to share about the two ways of communicating what you do as a filmmaker compared or in contrast to an author.
Oh, they're so different. And
yes.
I suppose with film, you have the power of being able to show, but you're limited because you can only show what you've managed to record. So it often has to be something that can be seen, or that you have to have been there and pressed record and been in focus and had the gear with you. So that means you're quite limited. And it's a bit stressful sometimes if you
sure.
know that you have to bring back the shot to prove the thing happened. I've been making films for 15 years and I love it. And it's been a tremendous privilege. And I love the craft of it and the lenses and thinking about the composition of the shots and that artistry. But the downside is all that stuff does get in the way. And in the same way that you mentioned the difference between scuba diving and free diving, if you turn up in someone's life and you ask to talk to them, when it's just you and a notepad, it's very different to when it's you and a film crew. You don't have to ask them to walk backwards and forwards five times so you can get a shot to go over the sound of them talking, you know? And so it's more intimate. You get to spend more time getting to know someone, and they don't care about what their hair looks like, because they're just talking to you. It's also much more personal. With filmmaking, the personal elements are often in what you decide to turn the camera towards, whereas with writing, it's the words you use.
Mm.
And those are very personal to you. And you can get a feeling across. It's also scary. It's more like being an artist, because if you make a boring film, you can always make it better by buying some footage, putting some nice music on top, and then playing with the colors to make it all look prettier, and people will kind of not notice. Whereas you're kind of stuck on the page, you're just your words. Maybe you can change the font, people will give you a few more paragraphs because
right, yes. And there's years of research for that, right? Which font does what and all the marketing PR and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's wonderful. I guess for me, I am a curious person. And I like the freedom to follow my interest and meet people and see into their worlds and spend time in the natural world and meet animals and see into their worlds. And writing and filmmaking both give you different opportunities to do them and different ways of meeting people. I feel like people who've read my book feel they know me a lot more than people who've seen my films. But I find that strange because I poured myself equally into both of them.
Mm. Yeah, it's kind of like if you listen to a certain band long enough, I feel like, oh, they're my friend. I know them.
Yes.
Right.
Well, I think there's also a difference between the audiobook and the written book.
Mm.
I guess also your relationship with a book, it travels with you while you're reading it. And if you're listening to it while you're driving to work or you're in the supermarket, you're going for a walk, it becomes fleshed out by your imagination. It kind of knits itself into part of your lived experience. And with a book, you put it down and you look up and you think, oh, I'm just going to think about that for a moment. And you're in bed and you turn to your partner and say, I just read this bit. Whereas with a film, it tends to be in one go, one sitting. So you have a very different relationship. You're not using your imagination so much with a film, but you are feeling a lot. The flip side is it's quite hard to read a book next to someone on a sofa at the same time and both gasp when the same thing happens. So you perhaps lose that communal nature of experience in your audience that you get with a reader.
Tom, in closing, would you tell the story of Humphrey? I love that story.
Of course, yes. So Humphrey was a humpback whale that went into the San Francisco Bay under the Golden Gate Bridge and got stuck going up one of the tributaries that lead out to the sea there. And that is a really bad thing to happen if you're a whale. Humpback whales don't live in freshwater and they're used to big open spaces, not narrow riverine spaces. So people were very concerned that Humphrey would die because that's what mostly happens when marine mammals go up into freshwater systems. And then there was a woman called Diana Reese, and she is an expert in the thinking capacities of dolphins. She did experiments where she put a mirror in a dolphinarium, and the dolphins that were there saw their reflections. And she was able to test and prove that they knew that it was them, so the idea that they had a self, which might seem intuitive now, but something you had to try really hard to persuade people of a couple of decades ago. And she decided with the team to try to get it to change its course, to help lead it out to sea. They would play recordings of other humpback whales in their feeding grounds to see if that drew his attention. And so they put speakers underwater and they did that. And he immediately did so. And over a couple of days, they were able to lead him out to freedom and survival. And he swam out under the Golden Gate Bridge. And it was a huge media moment. And he was seen later out in the Farallon Islands, so he survived. Diana spoke at this really beautiful moment where he, having been led out, suddenly came right alongside the boat and stuck his head up, looked at the people who'd been playing him these sounds of these other whales of his kind, and she said everybody burst into tears. And then he swam off and breached spectacularly. And she said that was the most important moment of her life.
We've been speaking with Tom Mustill. For anything Tributaries related, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.